Welcome to This Week in Money. I'm Jim Goddard. Today, Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com runs down the major markets. He tells us the so-called Santa Claus rally has started to set up and that gold and silver are starting to look attractive again. Publisher of the realestatetiming.com newsletter, Robert Campbell, checks in from San Diego to comment on the U.S. real estate market. He says San Francisco's market is collapsing as people flee the troubled city. Author of the book The Money Bubble, John Rubino, warns massive layoffs in the tech sector could be the precursor to a major recession next year. He tells us where you might want to put your money to protect yourself from it. We'll talk to Ross Clark right after this.
Introducing Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclico's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclico Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB, AMYZF, and Frankfurt 2AM. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
Welcome to This Week in Money, the source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com, where you'll find insightful market commentary and timely technical analysis. Check him out on Twitter at chartsbyRoss. Welcome back to the show.
Always good to be with you, Jim.
Ross, how are the stock markets shaping up? Are we seeing a Santa Claus rally forming?
Oh, Santa is right around the corner here, and the elves are already doing their work because we've been rallying since the middle of October. And classically, that's where you expect to see your seasonal low, and by the time you get to the 1st of November, things really start to come to life, which is exactly what we're seeing this year. We had some other modeling which had some resistance levels that were of concern, but those levels have been taken out. And, if we look at the rate of change here over the last 2 months, Dow is up 20% over a two-month period. The S&P is up 12%. And for all that those would seem like big rates of change and overbought circumstances, historically, when we go back and look at the last 100 years or more, when you have a rate of change like that, there is follow-through for the next couple of months. So seasonality aspect that's into play right now, which is typically the strength for this six-month stretch into the end of April, the early part of that move, the first few months of it, appear to still have some more running room left in it. We'll take a look in terms of where the market gets a little ahead of itself, and classically, as you move towards Christmas, the middle of December, you can see a bit of a pause before the next run. So just be on the cautious side for the short-term traders right now, but I think for anybody on the investment side of the position, as long as we don't take out any supporting lows that we've seen in the last two or three weeks, I think you just ride with this trend to the upside right now.
Any action on the bond front?
Yes, the employment numbers came in very strong. Bonds sold off a little bit here on at the end of the week, but overall, we had the type of upside extremes that we like to see at major reversals, and that all happened a few weeks ago. And here we've got, the 10-year yield has dropped off dramatically. You take a look at the 30-year, we've gone from a 4.42 yield down to 3.60. So for all that you got headline news and all the pundits out there guessing on what the Fed will do on the next move, the bond market has been having a great rally off the bottom. We're up to about 129.5 on the long bond. Our target remains 132 on that one, and we're starting to get reasonably close to that.
The U.S. and Canadian dollars.
U.S. dollar has retraced a Fibonacci 38% of the move from the December 2020 bottom. And historically, the big rallies, when they've got overextended, and we've got about 7 or 8 of those examples in the last 40 years, that 38% retracement is the norm. Moving average support is right in here as well. So if you look at either the DXY or the UUP, which is the ETF, that 38% level, we're just flirting with it right now. And I would expect to see it try and do some bottoming out either right in here or maybe a couple of points beneath it. But overall, the big trend is still to the upside. So be looking for support in here and look for some bottoming indications over the next couple of weeks.
The Canuck Buck?
With the movement here that we've seen in commodities, where the oil market has ended up with a lid and testing support, and you take a look at the agricultural markets, same type of thing, stuck in a trading range. What happens with the Canadian dollar, as always, as a commodity-based currency, or a resource at least, we saw the lid at 75.60. That really, I think, is going to be a dominant overhead right now. So I wouldn't get too excited about anything on the upside there.
What's happening with gold?
This has been a great one. We got a nice triple bottom in gold down at the 1640 level. Had great signals in terms of the oversold, the simultaneous ones in gold and silver. And silver's been leading the move off the bottom significantly since the middle of or the end of September. The ratio of silver to gold just breaking out of a really, really nice downtrend. And if we look at the miners, they've been participating with the move. In terms of the gold price, we've retraced a very nice 38% on the initial rally off the bottom. If we take a look at the targets there, the 38% did produce on the nearest futures resistance around 1790. Had a nice pause there. And this is the classic in terms of coming off bottoms. If you take a look at the gold lows all the way back to 1975, 1976. First rally is typically a 38% retracement. You come back and test your recent breakout, which in this case was around the 1730-ish level. And then you have your second rally, which ends up retracing about 55 to 57% of the decline. So that's going to give us a target for this current rally that started about middle of the week. 1870 is a really nice target for this run, and I think it's got some easy potential to get there. And we are in the seasonally strong period as far as gold is concerned. The latter part of the this calendar quarter, right in through February of next year. So as long as it just likes to stair step up, which is typical for gold coming off the bottoms, every pullback, you know, can give back 50% of a move and just hold on its breakout. So I'd say that the 1770 is a good support with 1870 is a good upside.
Ross, thank you so much for being on the show.
It was a pleasure, Jim.
My guest has been Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com. Find him on Twitter at chartsbyross. Coming up, Robert Campbell next on This Week in Money.
Always consult your investment professional before making any investment decision. Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com. This Week in Money is archived online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is Robert Campbell, publisher of the RealEstateTiming.com newsletter and author of the book, Timing the Real Estate Market. You can find him online at realestatetiming.com. He's speaking to us from beautiful and warm San Diego. Bob, welcome back to This Week in Money.
Thank you, Jim.
Bob, when's the...
to be back. And everybody, just so you know, everything's relative. When we say warm San Diego, we're in a cold streak right now. It's 55 degrees.
so that would be about 14 Celsius. Vancouver right now is zero. It's had a major snowstorm that some people took them 13 hours to get home because the snowstorm happened during the evening commute. So the plows and salters and stuff couldn't get on the road because of all the accidents.
Hey, not only is it 55 degrees right now, but the ocean is about 60 degrees. That's cold. No, it's in the 50s. It's 55, too.
Yeah.
The ocean temperature, guys, down here in San Diego, it gets down to the low 50s. That's why I never got into surfing. The water down here is freezing most of the time. During about 2 months during the summer, it gets into the 70s. Otherwise, it's 50s, 60s kind of stuff, and I don't like cold water. I'm too skinny.
Well, that's why I use my indoor pool. I'm too much of a wimp to use ocean water as well. Although a good friend of mine, Jill Bennett, she swims in the ocean every day.
I know. I have friends like that that are fanatics. The cold water doesn't bother them at all. I mean, they're just like they take to the water like a fish. And I go, not for me. Even the surfers down here during the wintertime, you know, they all have to wear wetsuits. Wearing a wetsuit is a pain in the ass when you're surfing. It's one too many things you need on you. You know, my perfect ocean temperature is Hawaii. It never gets below 70. You know, and so you don't need wetsuits and all that stuff, but it gets cold down here. You're out there in water that's like, you know, in the, like, 50 degrees. Oh, you're shivering. It's just not fun, even with a wetsuit on.
Yeah, well, in Tofino, where we surf off Vancouver Island, I think you need a wetsuit all year round because it's just cold. Anyway, Bob, my question, first off, when's the next edition of the Campbell Real Estate Timing Letter going to be published?
That's going to be January 15th. I just published the November 15th issue a couple weeks ago, and I published my timing letter once every 2 months. So that just went out. And that was really, I enjoy putting all of them out. It's such a fascinating subject, you know, real estate markets and, you know, determining the best times to buy and sell and using all the tools that I have. But the last issue, I looked at the United States and California, and using the principle of reversion to the mean, I showed everybody, all my followers, how far housing prices are likely to fall during the next downturn. And it was a lot. Because this boom down here that we've had, it's of the same magnitude that the last real estate boom was. And housing prices in the United States fell 35%. And in California, they fell 55%, and we're going to be in that same ballpark range this time.
Mm-hmm. Under these kind of conditions, how important is your book, Timing the Real Estate Market, in estimating when you should buy or sell?
It's essential because I published that book in 2002, self-published, and it's the indicators I use and how I. The mathematical calculations I use to put them all together so to make sense of all the indicators, it's as true today as it was then. In fact, in the last 22 years, even though I don't use these indicators primarily, there's other indicators I use. But, guys, I'll tell you, let me make this real simple for you. Everything in life, up and down movement, is driven by supply and demand. So the closer you get to supply and demand, the closer you're going to be to market movement. You know, when there's more demand than supply, prices go up. When there's more supply than demand, prices go down. It's that simple. So you have to know what key indicators to focus on that are primarily driven by the forces of supply and demand. And they have to be leading indicators. They can't be lagging indicators. So it's a magnificent obsession of mine, you know, to be able to predict markets like this. And using the indicators that I use, my success rate with predicting the rise and fall of housing prices is in the range of 80 to 90%, which is huge, really huge. Most people don't have an idea at all, you know, how far housing prices are ever going to fall from a peak. They just assume whatever the existing trend is, it's going to prevail into the future. And especially with California real estate, which is highly cyclical, very cyclical. You know, our housing prices in California dropped twice as much as the national averages during the 2006 through 2012 bust. And that they may or may not do that the same, but it's going to be close. So if you want to make money in real estate, the best place to be is in California. And then learn how to time the market. Because, I mean, that's what we're looking at right now, that in the next 5 or 6 years, the market's going to hit bottom. Housing prices are probably going to be down in the range of 40-50% off their peak. And that's the time to buy. Because when you make the best way to make money in real estate, guys, is to buy low. By far, that's the best thing. When you buy cheap, you can make a lot of friggin' mistakes along the way, but if you buy cheap, then everything's going to work out for you in the long run. So that's what I'm telling my subscribers now. Now you're going to have to be patient for the next 5 or 6 years to wait for the bottom, invest in alternative investments besides real estate, because why own real estate in a declining market, especially here in California? I mean, California is a capital gain state. It's not a cash flow state. If you want cash flow, go to Oklahoma or something. Go to Tennessee. But you don't want to go to California because the booms are huge and so are the busts. So if you want to make money on capital gains, come to California and time the market right, and you can make a lot of money in 6 years.
This week, the Fed Chair Jay Powell said the central bank's pace of interest rate increases can slow as soon as its December meeting. Is this just a Christmas present or a change in trends?
No, it's, you know what? He's trying to keep the markets elevated. But my view on inflation, knowing what I know about inflation, the research I've done on inflation, that he can't afford to back off and get these inflation rates down. I mean, so he can't back off and say, okay, inflation's going to 2% in 2023, because it's not. If you look at historically what has happened, once inflation gets above 8%, to get back in the 2 to 4% range, on average, it takes 5 years. 5 years. I mean, so everybody thinks that this is just a flash in the pan. No, it's not a flash in the pan. I mean, you know, every inflationary cycle is different, but this one, once you get inflation above a certain reach like that, 8%, and it wasn't, it got over 8% in the United States, it got, you know, it got 9.1. To get back to any normal level where inflation is low, and what you call low is like 2% or 3%, it could take 3, 4, 5 years. So in other words, can he afford to back off right now and say, okay, we're not going to lower interest rates anymore. In fact, you know, and we're just going to let inflation go. He can't afford to do that because everybody's going to get nailed by inflation. You know, the rich people, rich and poor, but especially the poor, they're just going to get slammed because that's what inflation is. I mean, the cost of living here in the United States, even though they say inflation's only like 7.7%, you could easily add 3 to 4 percentage points on that. Easily. You know, even construction costs here in the United States. And then they say that, you know, after the pandemic, things really shot way up, you know, year over year, you know, like 2x4s from Home Depot went from $3 to $9. Well, now they're down to $6. So, yeah, they've doubled in price in the last 5 years. So, overall, labor costs and material costs for construction on a year-over-year basis, are still in the 15% per year range. That's huge, guys. You can't afford to build a house when the cost of building that house is going to be 15% more today than it was, you know, last year. And housing is already unaffordable. We're already at the upper limits of unaffordability. And that's one of the things I use to help call turns in the marketplace. When things get unaffordable, the trends change. The trends change. Because nobody can afford a house. And housing payments here in the United States during a 2 year period went up 100%. 100%. So if back in 2 or 3 years ago, if your average mortgage payment for the average priced house in the United States cost $1,000, fast forward to today, it costs $2,000 a month. People can't handle that. No way. housing is so unaffordable in the United States right now that, you know, and what happens when it gets unaffordable? The prices come down. And how do you know that? Just go back and look at charts. Look at price history going back 40, 50 years. All of a sudden, unaffordability gets to be a certain level. What happens to real estate prices? They come down. Okay, then after they come down, then it goes up. Then it goes back up, and housing prices become unaffordable again in a different year. What happens? They go back down to become affordable. It's a repeating pattern, everybody. It's cyclical. It's the nature of things. And that's how you can make. I use key indicators to call turning points in the market, but I study history to determine how far housing prices are going to fall from peak levels before they're likely to hit bottom. That's just studying the past to predict the future. And
what could slowing interest rate increases mean for home prices?
What do they mean for home prices? They mean that they're going to come down. They have to come down. So, you know, only thing that's holding the market, one of the things that's holding the market up right now in California, even though we're down across the board, and California is the least affordable state, it is the weakest state in the country right now, the fact that people are hesitating to put their homes on the market to sell because they think, oh, I don't want to be selling in a bad market, and, you know, interest rates are going to be back down to 3% in no time flat, and that's when I'm going to sell my house. And that's what they're betting on. That ain't going to happen. They're not coming back down to that level, you know, at least for any length of time before they go shooting back up. And the reason you can't let inflation run. So if inflation right now is at 10.7% in the United States, and interest rates are at where should mortgage rates be historically to offset the higher cost of higher cost of living? They should be 3 percentage points above the rate of inflation. They should be 10.7%. And what are they? 6.7%. So they're still 6 percentage points, you know, too low, and that's where we got to get to stop inflation.
If central banks stop printing money, would that stop inflation? Although, what would that do to the economy at the same time?
Well, it would crash the economy first, because the U.S. right now, that we're running, that if you look at that, you know, on balance and off balance sheet items, we're running deficits in the range right now of $2.5 trillion. I mean, during the pandemic, they printed up, I think it was $5 trillion to stimulate the economy, but now that we are still living way above our means, way above our means. And it's primarily that the tax revenue is about $2 trillion short of covering the outgo for the federal government. And most of that, guys, is Medicare and Social Security entitlements. Because those things are going nowhere, went up, and they aren't collecting enough money to cover it. So I would say probably $1 trillion of that is to cover entitlements. And are you gonna cut back on your budget and cut back on Social Security and Medicare? No, you totally crash the economy. So they have no choice, guys. They have to keep printing money. They have to try to slow down things. But as you may have heard the expression, inflate or die. Well, that's been true for years, decades, and it's still true today. They can't stop printing money. They can't. The other one, okay, let's say we're running a $2 trillion deficit, fiscal deficit, budget deficit every year. The only other way to come up with that is to tax people more. We're already close to 20%, and you go above that, where all of a sudden you have to start taxing people like in the 25 to 30% range, everybody's going to be broke. Everybody's going to be broke. So, you know, it's like, even though I'm not a doom and gloomer about this, but the noose is tightening, guys, around the point where you just can't afford to pay the debt anymore. The debt, and so we could easily have a sovereign debt crisis wherein that governments all over the world just have to somehow default on their debt. And I don't think they're ever going to default on the debt, because here's the ace up the sleeve. They can revalue gold to a big number and back the currency and back the debt so the system doesn't crash. And that's why I'm anticipating gold in the range of anywhere from $10,000 to $50,000 an ounce. It's going to be a fail-safe method. It's going to be a Hail Mary pass that's going to work for a while just to back up the currency.
Is credit being tightened?
Yes, sure. Credit always tightens during housing market downturns. We're just at the beginning of this, everybody. Mm-hmm. Here in the United States, this is likely to take 6 years before we go from peak to the bottom. So we're just getting started. We're about like six months into this right now. And so, you know, the market's still holding up relatively well, even with high interest rates, because people aren't putting their houses on the market. They're hoping the market's going to turn. But this thing's going to last a long time, and it's going to be a grinder. It's going to be a grinder. The last time housing prices turned down in California, back from 06 to 2012, if you adjust for inflation, it took 14 years to get back to break even. 14 years. So you have 14 years of pain and suffering as a real estate investor that you're going to have to endure just to get the purchasing power of your money back. That's a lot of pain and suffering, guys.
Are earlier mortgage rate hikes showing up now in home prices?
Gradually, yes. Gradually they are. Home prices are definitely coming down right now. But like I said, they've just started. Here in California, peak prices occurred in April of May of this year, 2022. Here nationally, peak prices are about 2 months later than that. But they're coming down across the board. Everywhere they're coming down across the board. And the only reason they're not coming down faster, again, we go back to our old a reliable rule of supply and demand. Even though demand for housing is down 40%, that's huge. That's a crash. Even though it's down 40%, but the supply of new homes hitting the market is down about 30%. And that's really unusual. At some point, people are going to get scared, and they're going to go, I'm not waiting anymore. Housing prices are now down, let's say they're down 5%, then 10, and then it goes to 15 and go, I'm going to sell. And that's when people are going to dump inventory on the market just to get out. Just like they do in any market. You know, they get scared, and here comes the inventory. They go, you know what? This isn't going to get better. And once we get into a full year, maybe a year and a half of this, that's when the supply is going to hit the market.
What is the latest on the U.S. housing markets and especially California?
Well, as I previously mentioned, Jim, it's like California is the weakest housing market in the country, and San Francisco is the weakest housing market in California, interestingly, or maybe not so interestingly. People are moving out of the Bay Area because it's like psycho land. But so the trend is down in California, and the trend is down in the United States. California has already experienced much greater price decreases. You know, since they peaked in May of this year, I believe, housing prices in San Francisco are down 8%, they're down 5% in San Diego, and they're down 4% in L.A. And nationally, you're still in the 2% range. So California is definitely where the weakest markets are.
How long can real estate bear markets run for?
Typically, historically, 6 years. California, 6 years. So the California, it's easier to predict California real estate cycles because it's so volatile, and the peaks and the valleys can be illustrated so clearly that you can see the cyclical behavior. Like most, California is twice as volatile as the United States. So the peaks are lower in the United States, and so are the bottoms. So California, everything's amplified. But typically bull markets in California housing prices last 6 years, down markets last six. Up six, down six. Up six, down six.
Do real estate bear markets usually have lower than normal sales volumes?
Absolutely. And that's, they, that I anticipate that, that volume will drop, 50% and stay down 50%. That's why it's so devastating to people in the real estate business. How about real estate agents? All of a sudden, it's been nothing but blue skies and sunshine for the last 10 years. All of a sudden, and you're living off a certain income stream. Let's say you make $100,000 a year. Now all of a sudden you get in a bear market and your income drops down to 50 a year. Well, believe me, you weren't banking $50,000 a year when you were making $100. You're probably spending $100,000 or more. Now you're in trouble. You can't afford your standard living. You can't afford that new lease, that new lease on that new Lexus that's costing you $1,000 a month. You can't even afford the mortgage on your house because you moved up to do a bigger house, because you're making so much money. Now you can't afford your house. You can't afford anybody's income that falls by 50%. You got a big problem, and that's the nature of real estate. I've seen it cycle over cycle over cycle over cycle. You know, going back to the 50s and 60s. It's the same thing. I've seen people that are just flying high, agents, companies that are flying high during the boom, and they go bankrupt during the bust. That's not as unusual as you may think. I know companies, good companies, have gone bankrupt twice. You know what? Because they don't know how to handle the down markets. They can't handle them. So, you know, all of a sudden they're spending all this money on marketing. You know, it's marketing driven, which is expensive. And all of a sudden, and I have a friend that's in the same business right now. That he's been a subscriber for 20 years. He's become a good friend. He's been in real estate sales with his own company, just a four-man group or something. And for like 30 years, he sells on average 50 houses a year. So he's making a lot of money. Right? He called me up a couple weeks ago and he said, Bob, I have 5 listings and the phone isn't ringing. I mean, the guy's got money, but he's got a $3 million house. He's got jet skis. I mean, he's living large. His wife makes a good living. But all of a sudden, he's sitting there going, my income's going to fall 50% over the next 6 years. Can I handle that? I could tell by his voice. He didn't tell me he was in trouble, but I could just tell. Nobody's looking forward to a pay cut of 50%. Most people can't handle that. And living here in San Diego, you know, household income, you got to be making $250,000 a year just to afford housing. And the taxes and the cost of living. Southern California is a very expensive place to live. Any place in California for that matter. But the closer you get to the beach, you know, our median priced home here in San Diego is like $900,000. In San Francisco, it's 1.6 million. In Silicon Valley, it's 1.6 million. LA, it's like 800,000. Those are big numbers, guys. So, I mean, you know that there's a lot of people, it takes a lot of money to be able to afford to pay for a $900,000 house and the cost of living. I mean, we have the highest gas prices in the country. Everything's more expensive in California. Cause it's a liberal paradise. So, you know, everybody, people that don't work, everything free, and they throw it on the backs of the other people. We have the highest tax rates in the country. You know, I think it's like 13 or 14 or 15%. State tax. So, I mean, it's expensive to live in California, and that's why people are moving out. People that have money and need the money to retire on, and I know this from real estate agents, they said, yep, the last 10 houses I've sold, I've listed and sold, how many of those people are moving up or moving down, say, in California? They go, 1 or 2. What are the other 8 or 9 doing? They're leaving. They're going to Texas. They're going to Arizona. They're going to Florida, where it's a lower cost of living. And now we have inflation thrown into the mix, which we didn't have in the last downturn. So this is going to be really interesting, guys. And let me know, all the comments I'm making to you right now are based on what's happening right now. I can change my mind on market conditions anytime, although it's doubtful in real estate, because I know the cycles last a long time, and it's just a persistent downward move. But, you know, I doubt that. No way are they going to revive this real estate market and bring it back. For one thing, if you look back at the last two downturns we've had in the United States, the one that went from 90 to 96 and went from 2006 down to 2012, during that period of time, interest rates were falling. In the first downturn, I think mortgage rates fell by 2%. In the last bust, mortgage rates fell by 3%. Was that enough to save the market? No. Wasn't even close. So when these things build up momentum on the downside, they just keep going, guys. And it doesn't matter if interest rates are 7% or if they're 5 or if they're 4, because the psychology takes hold. The prices are going down. So there's more of a urge to sell than there is buy. Now that there's supply and demand for you again. Now there's more sellers than buyers, and the buyers are reluctant, and the sellers are eager. Therefore, you have because prices are still high. Therefore, prices go down.
When real estate bubbles pop, does the largest percentage of the drop occur quickly, with the smaller percentage continuing over time?
Oh, it's rather steady. It starts kind of slowly. where, I mean, at the top, where all of a sudden you can see prices fall, then all of a sudden they'll take a leg up because people think, oh, that's a real deal. I can buy this house at 5% less than the last guy bought it at. Well, he's just catching a falling knife. But typically, it's just a slow, steady, persistent, relentless decline until it hits bottom, and it wears you out. It's not like a stock market, where the stock market hits, you know, from peak to bottom is like a year and a half or so, right? Then it's over. Real estate is 6 years. So it just beats on you. It just pounds you. I'm losing money. Yeah, you're losing money. Well, when's this going to go away? In about another 4 years. Oh, shit. Really? Really? And that's why people just can't handle it. They can't handle. They can't sleep at night, and it affects people in so many ways. It affects their health. In the last downturn, people committed suicide when they lost everything. You know, on paper, they were millionaires. After the crash, they're broke. A lot of people commit suicide, and they do. And it's very bad for your health, everybody. And for those that follow me on Howe Street, you know how important health is to me. It's numero uno. And what's number two? Is well behind numero uno. So I'm into anti-aging, not accelerated aging. And owning assets that go down in value will definitely increase your stress and make you look older and unhealthy. And so that's why I don't like to lose money. I'm very, very, I manage risk very carefully in everything that I do. And that's probably why I have a certain degree of financial comfort at this point in my life that most people don't have. I'm not rich, but I'm not poor, and I got a good business. And so, in other words, life is good. But when you're sitting there you have a house that's worth $1 million, and 6 years later it's worth $500,000, you know what you feel like? You feel like crap. You feel like crap. So, you know, those are the things you got to avoid in life. And you try to avoid, and it's not easy, but it can be done.
What are some of the biggest mistakes real estate investors make?
The biggest mistake they make is they assume whatever the prevailing trend is, it's going to continue into the future indefinitely. They don't call the turns. They think, oh, yeah, the market's good for another year or two. The market's good for another year or two. And they say that right at the peak, and they buy at the peak because the market's good for another year or so. Then it turns down, and 2 years later, you know, the price is down 20%. And they're underwater because they didn't put 20% down on that house. They put 10% or 5%. So now that bought a $1 million home for and they have a $950,000 loan, and now their home's worth $800,000 2 years later. They're in a world of hurt. World of hurt. And just say, for example, that, you know, a recession is looming. You know, the real estate, the economic cycle tends to ride with the real estate cycle, you know, very highly correlated because everything considered, you know, all real estate endeavors compose about 15% of the entire economy. So when real estate turns down, all of a sudden turns down by 50%, now that 15% of your component of the economy turns down by 50%. And that's a big hit. That's why during real estate downturns typically result in recessions because it's the building market turns down, everything turns down. So they're all correlated like that. And all of a sudden you get into a recession, unemployment's going to start picking up, people lose their job. And it's just the same old cycle over and over and over again, everybody. There's nothing new under the sun. This has been happening for centuries, and it's going to happen for centuries into the future. So you just have to be able to look ahead to figure out, like, what's most likely to happen next so that you can protect yourself. But if you're not looking into the future with some idea that are things going to get bad, you're just going to be roadkill.
What are some of the things that successful real estate investors have done?
What successful real estate investors do is they avoid or minimize the effects of down markets. So what you have to do, you have to start, maybe you don't want to sell everything, but you've got to lighten your load. And it depends if you have some alternative investment to go into. Most real estate people, all they know is real estate, which is fine. You can make a lot of money in real estate by itself, especially if you play the cycles correctly. But all of a sudden, that you bought back in 2012, and all of a sudden, and now housing prices in California are 150% higher here in 2020, 10 years, you know, 8 years later, sell your house. pay your tax and put the money somewhere else, you know, so it can make money as opposed to losing money. And everybody everybody tries to avoid paying tax. Well, I don't want to pay the capital gains. I don't want to pay the capital gains. Well, sure, nobody likes to pay taxes. But after 6 years of a down market and your house lost 40 to 50% of its value, guess what? You don't have a tax. The average guy doesn't have a tax problem anymore. You're lucky to get your money back. So in other words, you know what? That's just the nature of things. Deal with it, everybody. Pay the tax. Get away from it. Because most people say, well, oh, I'm never going to sell that house. I'm going to give it to my kids or something. Well, that's all good and well. But you look at like 10 rental properties. What percent of those are held for 30 or 40 years so they can give them to their kids? I would say I don't have any exact figures, but I would say based on my, you know, 60 years experience about the real estate field, I would say it's in the vicinity of less than 10%, probably 5%. And why is it so low? Because life events occur. If you get divorced, for example, and all of a sudden you have this rental property you've had for 20 years, guess what's going to happen to the rental property? Is that rental property going to be sold and divided between husband and wife, or is it just going to be held for the kid? It's going to be sold. Let's say somebody dies unexpectedly and you get their house. Are you going to hold that house for that period of time? No. You're going to sell it. So the average tenure of home ownership in the United States, there's, you know, different sources say different things, but I would estimate it's in the range of 7 to 10 years. So every 7 to 10 years, on average, a home gets purchased or sold. And that's not 30 years, guys. 7 to 10. So people don't take into the account that you can get surprised with things in life. You know, you can lose your job. You can get divorced. Housing prices can turn down, you can get into inflation, and all these kind of things. And that's why just everybody thinks that, you know, the United States may be the richest country in the world on a per capita basis, but I read a statistic yesterday. If you look at the median net worth of the average American, it's in the range of $200,000. That's it. $200,000. And if you get in this kind of economy where you're, you know, going into retirement, you're a baby boomer or something like that, and all you've got is $200,000, you're not going to make it, dude. That's not enough. And that's why all life is a struggle. Life, the markets are a struggle. It's a battle for investment survival all the time. And there's no finish line, guys. There is no finish line. As soon as you get complacent and say, oh, I've got it made, now you're vulnerable to get hit. Something can happen. So it takes risk management, personal management, business management, all the way through to hold on to what you got. But if you don't know how to manage risk, it's only a matter of time until you're going to get nailed. You know, and the national net worth statistics reflect that.
Do you have any real estate wisdom for us?
Yeah, buy low, sell high. That's the golden rule, guys. You want to make money in real estate? Buy when prices are depressed. Those times are worth waiting for. And the reason I've been so fascinated with market timing, I've always been driven, you know, to do things, you know, to make money and be comfortable financially ever since I was a kid. And then once in high school, I started investing in the stock market. And I went to my dad, who was a building contractor. I said, Dad, how do you make money in stocks? He goes, you buy low and sell high. I said, how do you do that, Dad? And he said, that's what everybody wants to know. And that's a guy that, you know, that built homes in Southern California for 55 straight years. So, and successfully, and without ever, you know, going bankrupt, which I think is a record. But, I mean, so that's what it is. And I just became fascinated with it. I started market timing stocks. And what I learned about market timing stocks, I applied to real estate. And, wow, it worked. As long as you're focused on the right indicators. But you got to be focused on the right indicators. And the way you do that, guys, is this. You got to be careful to what you allow to go into your brain. There's all these different things that people are talking about. Oh, yeah, confidence indexes, you know, misery indexes, unemployment rate, jobless rates, you know, all these kind of things. There's dozens and dozens and dozens of them. If you want to be a good real estate timer, what you have to do is only let the good into your brain. You only have to focus on, like, 5 to 6 to 7, you know, 5 major indicators, and you know right away what's going on because you know the correlation. That, you know, I've been doing this so long, I only have to work like even though I study the markets and things like that, I'm keeping track of the data is what I'm doing more than anything, is that I probably only work 2 hours a day to maintain a really strong real estate investment publication. Because I know what to look for. Everybody's coming out with all these things. Oh, yeah, did you hear, you know, this just happened yesterday. You know, the dollar's dropping. What does that mean? It doesn't mean anything. Don't bother. Don't put it even in your brain where it confuses you. Here's when you want to put in your brain. And this is according to my book. Existing home sales, new home building permits, loan defaults, foreclosures, and interest rates. If you just focus on those five indicators and wrap your brain around the fact that those are excellent indicators to watch for timing real estate markets, you'll be so far, you'll be ahead of 99.9% of all people. Don't worry about the other crap. I don't, because why let it into your brain? It'll just confuse you.
Your thoughts on the U.S. dollar.
The U.S. dollar was in a great bull run as long as up until about 2 or 3 months ago. Now it's declining. I expect the U.S. dollar to continue an upward movement because I expect the Fed to continue to raise interest rates. And the higher interest rates go, the higher the dollar goes. And why is that? Because all of a sudden, if you can earn 4.5% on a one-year CD in the United States, and that same which is almost risk-free, that same CD plays 1.5% in Europe. Where's the money going to go? It's going to go into the 1 year CD in the United States. Well, guess what? You purchase those 1 year CDs with dollars? I mean euros? No, you purchase them with dollars. Well, where do you get the dollars? You sell euros and buy dollars. So, now the dollar's been going down a little bit for the last month or two, and it's all because everybody's anticipating the Fed's going to pivot, interest rates are going to come crashing back down, and the dollar's going to crash. I don't anticipate that happening. I think this is just a short reprieve. The dollar's going to keep going up, and right now, my own personal portfolio, I've been invested in commodities for all of this year. Commodity index, which is 50% oil. And so I'm up six. My gain year over year so far to date is 4%. 4%. And which is anybody else doing that well? No. If you're in the stock market, you're down about 15. If you're in anything else, you're down even more. If you're in bonds, you're down 35%. So I'm up 4%. So is that anything to cheer about? Not really. Inflation's 8. I just lost 4 percentage points on my money by being a successful trader because the returns I'm getting on my trade don't cover inflation. So I'm a 4% loser too. And if you're down 35% in bonds this year, and then just add 8% inflation onto that, adjusted for inflation, you're down 48%. You've lost half the purchasing power of your money in bonds. If you've been in bonds for the last year. So everything's relative. So it's hard. Like I say, it's a battle for investment survival, everybody. And you got to be really on your toes, to stay ahead of the curves so that you're, and all I want to be is, I don't want to be rich. I'm way past that point in my life. What I want to be, all I want to be is in the top 10%. That's good enough for me. Not the 1%, not the 5%, top 10%. And that's harder to do than you think. And it's not because the bar is set so high. It's because the bar is set so low for everyone else. But that's all you got to be. Now you're comfortable financially. You don't have to worry about anything dramatic happening to you, that you're going to survive it. Because, that I'm 75 years old, so how much longer am I going to live? 10, 15 years? That kind of thing. I mean, really living well. Do I think I can last 10 or 15 years financially? Yeah, I do. I do think I can do that. So that's a real comfortable feeling to put yourself in, guys. And also from the standpoint, that's why I have a business that still generates a very nice cash flow for me. So it's not just my investment. I still got money coming in, every month to take care of things. In other words, so you can plan all these things in advance for yourself, guys. Does it take work? Yes, it takes a lot of work, but it's possible.
Your thoughts on gold?
I love gold. Anybody that knows me knows I love gold. I've loved gold. I love gold for the last 10 or 15 years. And even though, has it been the best investment over that period of time? No. Then why do you love gold? to this gold. And I anticipate gold is the ballast in my sailboat. That's what keeps me up overnight. And gold is liquid. I can take gold coins down to a coin shop and convert those into cash in 15 minutes. Just like you can with, can you do that with real estate? No. No, you can't. But if I need money, I can always sell gold. And interestingly, I've been accumulating gold for, let's say, the last 10 or 15 years, and I'm putting it all away for my retirement. I said, okay, when I'm 65 years old, I'm going to start slowing down. I'm going to start selling off my gold to retire. Interestingly, take a guess, Jim, how many ounces of my gold I've sold in the last 10 years?
None.
To help pay for bills?
None.
Exactly. Now, that's such a good feeling. That's because I have an income. I'm not, you know, people go, like, guys my age, they're retiring and they're playing golf all day. You know what? One, golf is boring. Two, golf isn't a sport. Three, golf is for old people. So I have more fun, you know, I work out like a maniac and sprint and, you know, lift heavy weights and things like that to stay strong and fit. But also I maintain a good business where I'm making a nice monthly income every month. And so I got the cash flow coming in. And I have control over that cash flow. After you've been in business for 22 years, my cash flow is pretty predictable, you know. And so, I mean, so you got the cash flow, and you keep working. And really, so, you know, most of my friends that are older and retired and are, like, just playing golf or babysitting their kids, they're going downhill. And I'll tell you one thing that I know Jim's going to ask me this, that in a, you know, real quickly, what tips do you have? This isn't a health tip. This is about a life, how to live your life, guys. Always keep moving forward. Always keep moving forward. You keep reaching for something greater than, something that's bigger than you already are. It can be a health achievement, a physical fitness achievement. It can be a financial achievement, or it can just be playing the game correctly. Like, we have a very nice home in Southern California that's paid for. What we're going to do at the Market Cycle Bottom, we're going to buy another home, a high-end fixer-upper, and we're going to move into it. And we're going to put a renter in our home, and we're going to buy low, add value going on the upside while enjoying a big home, and then sell it. Am I doing this for money, all for money? No. It's for the satisfaction that you're correctly playing the game. You're correctly playing the game. It's kind of like Warren Buffett. Do you think Warren Buffett is still talking about stocks and things like that and is a full-time investor because he needs more money? No! He's correctly playing the game. He's a smart... What else is he going to do? He doesn't golf. He's 90 years old, you know? But he's still playing the game and he's doing it well. And that's why he's 90 years old and still healthy.
Is the Dow looking bullish?
Yeah, interestingly, I gave up trying to time the stock market. I don't play the stock market. I'm a trader. I trade in and out and typically make an average annual return of in the range of 8 to 10% per year, good times and bad times, with very low drawdowns. That's all I want because I don't like to lose money. In the stock market, I mean, this thing has the potential, even though what the Dow dropped, like 25% or something like that, it has the potential to drop 50%. How much I hate losing money. Because all of a sudden you start going, wow, everything I worked for is going to go up in flames. Now, who knows how low it's going to go? It's going to go down 60. Maybe it's going to go down 70. Maybe it's going to go down 89% like it did in 1929. You don't know. But do I want to be, like, hanging around and just betting that it isn't going to do that? No. That's a bad news story that I will do my best to avoid. And I do.
Robert, where can people find out more about your book and newsletter?
They can go to my real estate website. It's called realestatetiming.com, realestatetiming.com. And you can buy my book called Timing the Real Estate Market. And you can, or you can subscribe to my timing letter. So the... you can do that. So, and the last thing I'd like to leave with you guys is this. Everything in life is a choice. You have the choice to make good decisions or bad decisions. So if you sit there in this market knowing what the potential downside is, let's say in California real estate, it has the potential or the likelihood even to go down 50%, and you don't sell, are you a victim? No, you're not a victim. You made the choice to hang in there. So you're not a victim. So you have control over most everything you do in your life. And so what you have to do is you have to get really, really good at making smart decisions. And the best way I know to make smart decisions, it starts with physical fitness that develops into mental fitness. But because you have to have the courage to act, to sell high when everybody's telling you you're nuts, you have to have the courage and the mental strength to buy low, to go against the crowd when everybody's telling you're nuts again. But that's how you get ahead in life. And it has to be this attitude, nothing can stop me. Nothing that's going to stop me. I watch these markets like a hawk, you know, saying that if all of a sudden if I see a major trend change and I'm in the wrong asset class, I'm not going to sit around and wait, well, let's see what happens over the next 6 months. Baloney. I'm gone. Color me gone. And if you do it correctly, guys, it can work out really well for you. You're not going to be a Warren Buffett. You're not. I know that all the real estate companies tell you how you can be a multimillionaire in 5 years in real estate, you know, with no brains, no money, no job, and a crappy credit score. But I've been around this business for 60 years, and that just isn't the way the world works. It's going to happen slowly. You develop your skills. You develop your market timing skills. You develop a discipline. When this happens, I'm going to do this. If this happens, I'm going to do this. And you do that over the course of a lifetime, all of a sudden you'll be 60, 65 years old, and if you want to retire and play golf, guess what? You'll have the financial wherewithal to do it. But if you don't do those things, there's a lot of older people in my age group that are still working, and it's not because they love working at a Rite Aid pharmacy. It's because they have to work at those places. So the first things first, take care of your body, take care of your health. That's number one, numero uno. And second thing is then make good decisions financially. Know how to move money, out of bad asset classes into other asset classes that offer more promise at the time. So, I mean, and then if you do that over the course of the lifetime, everybody, you got a chance. I don't want anybody to become overconfident, because I'm certainly never overconfident, and I don't teach that to any of my followers. But it's like, but that's the minimum requirement. And don't get in debt. I was just talking to a kid today. I train with a kid. I've got a personal trainer, and we do high-intensity training. He's 21 years old. He's going, I'm trying to figure out whether I should go to college and get into debt, you know, like $150,000 a year. And I go, are you nuts? And even his dad's telling him that too, because he's an entrepreneur. He's going, you know, the worst thing you can do is all of a sudden go to a university, incur $100,000 worth of debt into some obscure, subject matter that you majored in. What are you qualified to do when you get out? You can be a barista at Starbucks. And he goes, I know. I said, that's what most people do. I advise most kids nowadays in the world, the young kids, as opposed to going to college, if you got a business sense and a drive, I said, go work for a Fortune 500 company in sales. Sell something for 5 years and get into a good program because you're smart. They'll teach you how to sell. They'll teach you about the program, the product and all that. Something where it's like 50% salary, 50% commission. Do that for 5 years, and that is the best education you're ever going to get in the world in business, guys. You are going to grow up real fast, and that education is going to be worth 10 times more than a 4-year college education. So that's all I have to talk about for this episode, everybody.
Bob, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
Thank you, Jim. Bye.
My guest has been Robert Campbell, publisher of the realestatetiming.com newsletter. He was speaking to us from San Diego. Coming up, John Rubino, next on This Week in Money.
Introducing Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclico's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclico Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB, AMYZF, and Frankfurt 2AM. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
This Week in Money is archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is John Rubino, author of several books on the economy, including The Money Bubble. He founded the website dollarcollapse.com. He's speaking to us from Washington State near Port Angeles. Welcome back to This Week in Money.
Hey, Jim.
John, will the big story in 2023 be inflation or recession?
I think it's becoming clearer and clearer that recession is what's in our near future here. You've got big tech companies laying off tens of thousands of people, sometimes just one company laying off 10,000 people in the case of Amazon, and a lot of industrial commodity prices are plunging. So I think that that's going to slow the economy down to a point where we'll be in a kind of a technical recession of a couple of weak quarters. And then we'll see if it gets much worse from there. But I think 2023 is going to be the year in which the whole inflation thesis fades and morphs into something different.
Was the Fed's intention to cause a recession with rapidly rising interest rates?
Well, they knew they had to do something called demand destruction, where they raise interest rates and that causes people, either because they get laid off of their jobs or because they can't borrow money anymore or whatever, to consume less. And that causes prices to go down. You know what? They succeeded. They aggressively raised interest rates. The economy is slowing. The prices of a lot of things are falling. So they got what they wanted. Although in no way are they fixing our long-term problems. This is strictly like giving some opioids to somebody who has a sucking chest wound or something. It might get us through another day or, in terms of the economy, another few years. But the recession that we have that is coming is in no way going to fix anything.
How close is the Fed to capitulating and going back to easing?
Oh, that's really the interesting short-term question here, because everything will change when the Fed panics and starts cutting interest rates, which they will do at some point. Two things will bring that about. One is that the recession that is coming just keeps on deepening. In other words, negative 1% growth becomes negative 4% growth, and the Fed panics. Or when some big financial over-leveraged entity out there blows up. And the list of possible catalysts for that kind of a Fed capitulation are myriad. We could probably name between us, you and I, 10 or 15 different things that could happen to terrify everybody and send the world's central banks back to aggressive ease again.
John, I remember this time 3 years ago when the markets were just skyrocketing, and I asked, what do you think could stop this this rampant rise in stocks and so on? And you said, no, I don't know, maybe a pandemic. How right you were. Because you said we seem to be due for one. We didn't know what it would be, but you just said, looking at world history and stuff, that would be the disruptor.
Well, that was always definitely on the list, because it's a thing that happens once in a while. We're always having new diseases pop up, and it's just a matter of time before something really communicable comes along. And instead of just being, a pig virus or chickens or something that only strikes one little segment of the human population, a thing that's dangerous for everybody. So that was always going to happen, and we got it sooner than expected.
China seems to be devolving into chaos. Why is this happening, and how big a problem is it for the rest of the world?
Well, China's a dictatorship with really bad demographics. So they were headed for some kind of a crisis in any event. But this latest one regarding COVID is, I think, can be derived from the fact that, dictators think they can just issue orders and the world responds to their orders by getting in line and doing what the dictators want. So they're trying that with COVID. They're basically trying to ban a respiratory disease.
which is completely impossible. So what they're doing is if one person in a city tests positive for this disease, they shut down a big chunk of that city, and they're, you know, they're carting people off to quarantine centers, which look suspiciously like outdoor prisons, and locking people in their apartments. There was just an apartment that caught fire, but the COVID police had locked the doors from the outside. People couldn't get out. 10 people died. And so there are riots spreading all over China right now in response to this. And this is by far the biggest threat since at least Tiananmen Square to the continued rule of the current dictator. We'll see where this goes. You know, it's more than likely to end with a lot of people being killed by police shooting automatic weapons into crowds and then carting off the survivors. But you never know. This might actually topple China's government. And that's a huge deal for the rest of the world. This is the second biggest economy and the manufacturer of all kinds of crucial products for the rest of the world. So let China devolve into chaos, and so does a big chunk of the rest of the world. You know, we can't escape the implosion of the second biggest economy without a lot of pain ourselves. So China, I don't know, picking the biggest story that's out there right now, it's kind of hard to do, but China's got to be in like the top three of the serious things that we need to be watching, because they could be very consequential for everybody.
Are we tempted at all to give them help to deal with their crisis, or should we just let them muddle through it?
Well, there's nothing we can do. Yeah. I mean, they, I suppose we could give them a bunch of vaccines, but that doesn't seem to be their preferred response. So they're going to do what they're going to do. And it's especially strange for them to be behaving that way when you've got models like Sweden and Florida and Texas. Mm-hmm. Which basically just, you know, they encouraged people to get vaccinated, but other than that, they didn't shut their economies down. Their economies thrived. Everybody got the disease. Almost nobody died from it. And natural immunity is now basically the norm in places like that. So China could adopt that model, but that's really alien to a dictatorship's mindset, because you don't just let things work themselves out. You tell things to behave in the way you want them to behave. So I don't know. You know, they've got models that they can use that would give them a much better outcome, but they're choosing this absolute crazy response. And it looks like they're going to pay some kind of a price for it, maybe a big price, maybe in terms of international reputation, maybe in terms of the strength of their economy, maybe in terms of the stability of their government. We don't know. But I'm sure there will be a pretty serious price to pay for this kind of miscalculation.
Yeah, and it also seems to me it's pretty bad for countries that have very high smoking rates and high air pollution rates when you have a respiratory disease running around.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And China also has a rapidly aging population, yeah, too. So you got smokers, you got old people, and you've got still a lot of poverty there, too. So those three things together make a pandemic a dangerous thing. However, it's pretty clear from the way it played out in a lot of other places that the way to deal with it, even so, you know, you might want to try to quarantine your over 75-year-olds or something like that. But other than that, just, you know, let the kids go to school, let people go to their jobs, and let the healthy people get the disease, recover from it, and have natural immunity, and then life goes on. You know, that seems to be the way that that the most successful places have responded, and they're basically glad they did. I think everybody in Florida, or most people in Florida, are pretty happy with the way it played out.
What does the collapse of multiple crypto exchanges mean? Is this the end of the concept, or just growing pains?
That remains to be seen. What happened just lately is a big, very influential, very powerful Bitcoin exchange, which is like a Bitcoin bank / brokerage house / hedge fund. It just blew up. And it turns out it was being run by a bunch of kids from a mansion in the Bahamas. And these kids did not know the first thing about banking. You know, apparently they didn't understand self-dealing or fiduciary responsibility, or having somebody in place to manage risks. None of that. They didn't have any of that. And so they were doing all this self-dealing and basically stealing money from their customers. And the thing has just blown up. And unfortunately for the crypto space, there are all these cross-ownership positions now where one Bitcoin exchange or one crypto exchange buys a chunk of another and one lends a bunch of money to a third. And so now we have to sort through all these cross-ownership stakes and who has what debt and what's going to blow up when. And since the implosion of the main crypto exchange, a lot of others have failed. And a lot of others will fail too. So the question is, does this destroy the whole concept of cryptos? In other words, do we lose faith in the idea of cryptocurrencies, and does the whole thing just go away? Or does it discredit the idea of non-Bitcoin cryptos, and does Bitcoin attract a lot of new money and really thrive? And we just don't know. And does it attract a lot of regulation from governments who, in any event, probably would like to destroy cryptocurrencies and replace them with central bank digital currencies, which are cryptocurrencies run by the government and basically used as a means of social control. So we don't know which of these things, either individually or in concert, will play out in the year ahead, because cryptos are basically a new asset class. It's a space where there's no history for us to draw on. So we'll just have to watch and see how this plays out. But the only thing I would say with certainty is that if you have some cryptos on a crypto exchange, get them out of there as soon as possible. Take possession on a hard drive or whatever, and then let the dust settle before you do anything else.
If the government moves to digital currency, will there be an underground economy using something else for currency? Perhaps that Chinese stuff that we've used for money for the last 5,000 years, gold.
Without a doubt, that's going to be one part of this process. Governments are going to try to impose their own cryptos on everybody, and they're going to try to entice us into these accounts with central banks, which central banks will use to surveil us. Basically, they'll know where we are and what we're buying, and they will be able to manipulate the value of the cryptos in our accounts in order to control us. So that's all going to happen. People will rebel against that by setting up black markets the way people always do when an authoritarian government is trying to impose its will on people who want to do a certain thing in a certain way. Gold and silver are going to be a big part of that, without a doubt. I think silver coins are becoming more and more important every day because that's liable to be one of the functioning currencies in a cashless world. In other words, if they just stop producing dollar cash, and all we've got is electronic money, and we don't like some aspects of that electronic money, we will try to find other things to be money, and silver is just in the perfect place for that because it's been money. We all know how it works, you know. And so I think the time will come when we go to the farmer's market with some silver eagles or some maple leaves, and the farmers there are more than happy to sell us all the fruits and veggies we want for that silver. Now, what will be the response of governments to that is the big question, and we'll just have to see. It could be China writ large, with our cities starting to look like Chinese cities right now, with protests everywhere and government soldiers waiting in. I hope it doesn't come to that, but there's liable to be some civil war aspects to the transition to digital currencies attached to social credit scores the way they have in China.
Credit Suisse looks to be imploding. Could this be the Lehman moment that everyone's waiting for?
Okay, so if we're going to talk about catalysts, what could threaten to blow up the economy and bring about a Fed capitulation here in the U.S. or central bank capitulation across the world? Credit Suisse looks like a pretty good candidate. It's a big Swiss bank, incredibly badly run, incredibly corrupt. Its stock is tanking. Its credit default swaps are going through the roof, which is to say people don't trust their bonds anymore and they want to buy insurance against a default by Credit Suisse. That's all happening. So it's a classic bank run now, which will probably cause Credit Suisse to implode and default. Then after that, there's a decent chance that Deutsche Bank, a big German bank that's also incredibly corrupt and badly run, will be the next thing to go. And then everybody will be looking around going, okay, who's next? I got to get out of my Goldman Sachs and JP Morgan Chase stock. I just don't want that exposure anymore. So we'll run the risk of a global bank run, at least on bank stocks and bonds, if not actual deposits. And central banks can't let that happen. So that would lead central banks to go back to aggressively cutting interest rates, maybe take us to negative rates again, and put us back and say where we were in maybe 2018, something like that, with a big chunk of the global debt having negative yields. But of course, the system probably can't handle that. So I think this capitulation will be when we find out the Fed just can't fix things. You know, there's no way to manipulate interest rates in a way that keeps a big chunk of the global financial system from just imploding. And the psychological change at that point is going to be fascinating, because if everybody tries to run away from financial assets and towards real assets all at once, can't be done. Those doors are too small for all the people wanting to leave the theater. So we'll see something that we've never really seen in our lifetimes, and a rational person would wish to never see. Because living through this is not going to be pleasant unless you are so prepared.
That Chinese curse, may you live in interesting times. Will gold and silver be hurt or helped by the coming slowdown and Fed capitulation?
My guess would be initially hurt. If the economy slows way down, that will probably bring with it a stock market crash. And gold and silver get sucked down during times like that. So they might go down with most of the other assets that are getting beaten up. But when the Fed capitulates in response to that crisis, that's usually great for gold and silver. So it wouldn't be a surprise for gold to drop to $1,200 an ounce U.S. before going to $5,000 U.S. in the space of a few years. So it could be one of those crazy roller coasters that are very hard to time, but make a fortune for the people who do time it well.
Gold miners, especially the juniors, really beaten up the last few years. Would this be a time to take a look at them?
Yeah, the really high-quality ones are always worth buying in a regular way. So I wouldn't say take all your money out of Apple and Google and move it all into junior miners right now. But I would say do dollar-cost averaging or something like that, where you take $1,000 a month, let's say, and you put it into the really high quality gold and silver miners, the big ones as well as the small ones, and just let that build up. So if they tank, then your next $1,000 will buy more stock. So that's the beauty of dollar cost averaging, because it buys more of whatever you're buying when the price is down. So your average price gets more and more attractive over time. I think if you do that gradually, unless everything blows up this month, you will better and better position yourself for what's coming. If you're pretty well stocked up with good quality mining stocks when things get really gnarly out there and the Fed capitulates, you'll make a ton of money from that point. You may be down overall on your portfolio at the point that the Fed capitulates. But at that point, you are exactly where you want to be. You will, you'll make 4 or 5, 10 times your money in a lot of the smaller stocks, and 2 or 3 times your money in the bigger ones. And you know, for some people that will amount to life-changing money. So this is the chance. If we get this right, then that's it for financial necessity for the rest of our lives. So a very consequential time coming.
Is there anything out there right now that scares the bejesus out of you? Like, oh my God, if this happens, we're all screwed.
Well, nuclear war.
I mean,
in NATO, we are behaving incredibly stupidly. We're picking fights all over the world, led by the U.S., but abetted by a lot of its partners. And, you know, we're picking fights with nuclear powers. So all you need is an accident when you've got these global military empires bumping up against each other. What if one of our fighter jets in the South China Sea panics and takes out a Chinese naval vessel. What if somebody sets off a theater nuke in Ukraine and nobody knows who did it and everybody's pointing fingers at each other, and some of the crazies in the U.S. decide that's our excuse to go directly after Russia? This is all possible, and this terrifies me. You know, a financial crisis, you manage it, you live through it. It can be a mess or it can be awesome, depending on how you're positioned, but you get through it. Nuclear war is not like that. You know, I don't want to see my kids incinerated. But that's what we're playing with, and that's what really terrifies me. The second thing is creeping authoritarianism. We talked about digital currencies, central bank digital currencies. That's one part of what looks like a coherent plan to enslave 99% of the population in most countries. And, you know, there's the pandemic lockdowns, which were kind of a test run to see if they could do it. Turns out they can do it. You can terrify a big chunk of our population into blind obedience. So combine that with a social credit score attached to your only source of spendable currency, and you've got a recipe for a dictatorship that is very hard to break because it's technologically based. It's so much more advanced than the average person's PC or laptop or whatever that there really isn't any obvious way to break free from it. And I see that happening too. That's also completely terrifying. But we also, at least we have some agency in that process. There can be protests. There can be people who create those black markets we talked about. So there are things we can do to slow that down and maybe derail it. It could be that in some cases our votes even count. But I wouldn't count on that too much going forward. But yeah, so the world is a terrifying place, basically. And all we can really do as individuals, or most all we can do, is focus on our own situations. In other words, get our finances in order. Make sure that we're indispensable at our job. Make sure that we're embedded in our community and that there are people who will watch our backs and be there to help us. If we forget some aspect of our prepping, they can come along and take care of it for us. We can do all that stuff, and we should be doing it aggressively right now. We should really be preparing for the worst case scenario in all of this. And as the old saying goes, hope for the best, but plan for the worst. And we should absolutely be planning for the worst right now.
John, thank you so much for chatting with us.
Great. Thanks, Jim.
My guest has been John Rubino, author of several books on the economy, including The Money Bubble. He founded the website dollarcollapse.com. And that wraps up our show for this week. We'd like to thank our guests, Ross Clark, Robert Campbell, and John Rubino. And thank you for listening. If you have any questions for the show or our guests, you can send them to info@howstreet.com. I'm Jim Goddard. We'll be back next week with more This Week in Money.
Comments made on This Week in Money are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any manner whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. This Week in Money is a production of How Street Media Incorporated. Executive producer is Tom Allen.